The Arab Gulf states have long played an outsized role in the global economy and geopolitics. Situated at a crossroads between Asia, Africa, and Europe, they include some of the world's major exporters of oil, gas, and religious ideas. Now, with war raging across the Middle East, the Gulf states have been caught in the crossfires of a new round of conflict between Iran and the United States. The fallout from the war is likely to ripple outwards into the world economy. Roughly one-fifth of the world's crude oil trade passes through the Strait of Hormuz, a critical choke point for global shipping that is now under threat from Iranian missiles, drones, and mines. Meanwhile, US President Donald Trump has threatened to unleash death, fire, and fury should Iran seek to close this vital waterway. But the ramifications of the war are not just economic. The conflict could also reignite regional rivalries and fuel sectarian discord between Sunni and Shia Muslims across the Middle East and beyond. So what does this crisis mean for the Gulf states and the world? What impact will it have on American alliances in the Middle East? And how will it reshape the future of the region as a whole? With me to discuss these questions and more is Shiraz Maha, reader in non-state actors at King's College London's Centre for Statecraft and National Security. Welcome to the podcast, Shiraz.
Thanks for having me.
So as someone who's lived in the Arab world and has observed the Arab world for many years, do you get a sense of what the mood is like in the Gulf states at the moment?
I think the Gulf states are dismayed. They really didn't want this conflict, and they were clearly lobbying beforehand to avoid the very set of circumstances that are transpiring right now. I think they were acutely aware of what the Iranian strategy would be. Iran threatened it for a long time, and it hinted at doing this, although, of course, not on this scale when we had the 12-day war last year. So for the Gulf states, which are themselves at this moment in a great period of transition and trying to open themselves up to the world, courting tourism, courting inward investment, really developing their projects along economic and tourist lines, this is a huge, huge problem for them. So yeah, there is a great degree of unease about what's happening. And I think some unhappiness too with Donald Trump personally. And of course, that is a leader and figurehead in the White House with whom they've traditionally had a very good relationship. They understand each other, both sides. And so this is the first major dink, I think, in that relationship, which is just prompting some discussion about how much can we rely on the United States?
And we could get into the Gulf states' relationships with the United States in due course. But I wondered whether to start with, you could just take us through these different countries. Of course, the Arab Gulf states are often lumped together because they're part of a common organization, the Gulf Cooperation Council, or GCC. But this can sometimes disguise a lot of political, religious, and demographic diversity within and across these states. Can you just take us through some of these countries like Bahrain, Kuwait, Qatar, Saudi Arabia, and Oman, and explain to us where they fit into the geopolitics of the Middle East?
Yeah, of course. So it's worth saying at the outset, of course, when you look at these countries, they're all really city-states apart from Saudi Arabia. And that really affects the way places like Kuwait, Bahrain, Qatar, UAE are able to organize themselves as sort of polities. And they all have sort of fairly distinct views in terms of how they do business and the way that they're thinking about the world. So I think the first one really out of the traps in terms of developing itself, opening up to the world, was the UAE. And it sort of sought to turn itself into this economic powerhouse and leveraging its economic might and developing that early doors compared to some of the other countries. It's also taken a fairly muscular sort of interventionist approach around the broader region, which worries, I think, the other GCC countries. So it was involved in Libya after 2011 in terms of actively trying to topple Gaddafi. It's obviously been involved in Sudan. That's attracted a lot of attention recently there. And of course, also in Yemen, where it sort of sought to back insurgents and really provoked the direct fury of Saudi Arabia. The other sort of smaller sort of city state, if we want to talk about it in that way, of course, is Qatar, which has developed very differently. And it sought to really pursue a sort of small state strategy in the context of having outsized reach in its diplomatic efforts. And so it set itself up traditionally as the interlocutor for difficult parts of the Islamist spectrum, so part of the, I suppose, Muslim world's polity that the UAE has always been extremely skeptical of and been quite absolutist in terms of saying no engagement with them, no compromise. By contrast, Qatar has hosted the Taliban. They have official offices in Doha, and they, of course, served as a broker for the negotiations with the United States that led to the eventual withdrawal of the US from there. Similarly, in Egypt, they had a relationship with the Muslim Brotherhood. So that's been their kind of approach. Saudi Arabia's positioned itself somewhere between the two. It's obviously the big hulking giant of the region and thinks in a much larger, much more strategic way. It's been pulled into some degree of competition with the UAE, particularly on economic matters. So the Saudis, for example, are obligating companies, I should say, that want to do business in the region to headquarter in Saudi. And that's trying to peel them away from the UAE to bring their capital and expertise to the kingdom instead. So there are these points of rupture that do occur between them. Of course, Qatar, you know, most famously was subject to the blockade, where again, it had was deemed to have acted in a way that crossed the tram lines of the other countries. And that's how it was explained to me by a senior Emirati official, actually before the blockade, but there was a sense amongst the other countries that the Qataris weren't respecting the pact. And the basic idea is that you can do as you please, you can pursue your own agenda, so long as you don't cross what the others are doing. So if country A is doing a particular thing, you can do whatever you want, just don't interfere with their agenda on that issue. I think the only other sort of major, sort of, I suppose, interesting point to make here is that, of course, in Bahrain, it has a large Shia population. And the Iranians have often sought to titrate the anger of that community at different times, depending on what's happening. And so in 2011, that was the first part of the Gulf that had a significant degree of uprising. And the Saudis were on the ground with boots pretty quickly to suppress that. That has happened again this time. There have been people coming out on the streets, and the Bahrainis, with Saudi help, have been very quick and very sensitive and alive to that in order to try and suppress that.
So how have the various Gulf states sought to navigate their relations with Iran since the Iranian Revolution in 1979?
Well, the Iranian Revolution comes as a big shock to Saudi in particular, which is, of course, traditionally the custodian of the two holy sites. It takes the big role at the moment. But there are three actual really significant events that happen in 1979. The Iranian Revolution is one, but the other one is the fact there is a guy called Juhayman al-Utaybi, who is a Saudi national in Saudi Arabia, who claims he's the Messiah. And during the Hajj pilgrimage, him and his followers launch an armed insurrection in the mosque in Mecca and say, you know, here's the Mahdi, he's returned. And that doesn't go down so well. And the Saudis manage to suppress it with the assistance of French special forces. But what it does do is it sort of starts this discussion within the House of Saud about the fact that there are these things that are happening with the world of Islam. You have the rise to power of this Shia political project over the water in Iran, and you have a domestic challenge also happening in your country. And then, of course, the Soviet Union invades Afghanistan, and that provides an outlet for these listless, angry young men who are searching for a cause to say, that's great, go to Afghanistan and fight jihad. So in that context, the 79 revolution has an impact. It does weigh in, and it sort of starts this broader Sunni-Shia competition. You see clerics in Saudi Arabia who are given more license to speak more publicly on social matters, push back quite dramatically on a number of aspects of Shia theology. But I would say it's more at the theological, clerical level of discourse, suspicion, and intrigue. The dam really bursts in terms of outright sectarian violence with the 2003 invasion of Iraq.
And obviously, Saudi Arabia, because it receives significant revenues from its oil exports, has been able to fund certain movements and madrasas and mosques around the Islamic world. Could you just touch on how Saudi Arabia's sort of financial influence has shaped the Islamic world and the Middle East since the 1980s?
So Saudi Arabia's always had a very large proselytizing arm, which again really took off post-1979. And Saudi Arabia's in the unique position, of course, because it's hosting the two most holy sites of Islam. All Muslims at some point will attempt to go and visit Mecca and Medina. And so, particularly in the pre-internet era, when pilgrims from Indonesia would come, Malaysia would come, there would be a raft of books available for them for free in local language to say, take this away. And that became a real opportunity for the Saudis to proselytize their version of Islam automatically around the world. And that gave them great purchase in terms of having reach and scope across the Muslim world. And they had these non-governmental organizations. You had the Muslim World League and the World Assembly of Muslim Youth, which were the two really prominent proselytizing arms. It's worth saying they had a pretty laissez-faire attitude to these organizations pre-9/11, and they certainly cropped up in different places, being linked to or connected to groups that the United States was extremely concerned about. And so this issue of, well, to what extent was this Saudi NGO, which is only an arm's length from the government, connected to this group out in Afghanistan? The reality of what was happening, rather than it being a direct chain of control, was that things were done extremely informally. Someone would know someone in one of these organizations and say, I'd like to build a school out in Afghanistan or in the tribal areas of Pakistan or elsewhere. And there was a degree of a largesse. Sure, why not? It's all for the greater cause. That has changed quite dramatically. There's obviously been a big attempt by the Saudis to clamp down on that, to professionalize this, to process and bureaucratize a lot of that. So there's a clear chain of accountability and, more importantly, control. And they've also been particularly good now at putting their own government scholars into these projects to oversee them. And so the narrative has completely changed around the way they do business.
I would like to turn now to two other states in the Gulf, and that is Qatar and Oman, and the role they've often played as mediators between the Iranian regime and Saudi Arabia, but also between Iran and the West. Where do they fit into this geopolitical landscape?
Both countries have been looking to set themselves up as intermediaries, to say, we can host diplomatic breakthroughs and be your regional partners in order to do that. The Qataris in particular have really accelerated that, as I say, with high-profile negotiations with the Taliban in the past and so on. But Oman has had a traditional relationship with the Iranians, and given Iranian skepticism and mistrust, they were then the real interlocutors, particularly in recent times, of course, in the run-up to the current war as well. You saw the Omanis very rarely go public, I think in a last-ditch effort to try and stop the Israeli and American strikes that took place about 11, 12 days ago now.
And it's interesting because for all of the tensions that this conflict will unleash now for Iran's relations with the Gulf, would it be fair to say that there was some form of diplomatic detente or thaw over the last few years? We saw in 2023 a Chinese brokered normalization of ties between the Islamic Republic and Saudi Arabia. Where is that thaw now?
So that thawing was really important because there had been such a long-standing degree of enmity, the shuttering of embassies in the countries, suspension of diplomatic relations. That moment in Beijing was significant. And I think it was welcomed. I followed a lot of the Saudi press around it, and of course, all the social media discussions that took place around that time. And you could see a number of things beyond just the re-establishment of diplomatic ties, ambassadors being sent, reopening of embassies, and so on. I noticed when delegations, mid-level delegations of civil servants, for example, from Iran who came to Saudi, the Saudis were sending police escorts to pick them up at the airport. And they were saying, you know, we've come as on behalf of the Crown Prince who's asked us to treat you as our brothers, to make sure, you know, we can expedite your process through the airport, get you over to Mecca quickly, all of that kind of stuff. And so there was a real sense of, I think, trying to reconnect and to suck some of the heat out of the tension. It's really important to stress Saudi Arabia is a status quo power in the region. It doesn't like uncertainty. It doesn't like turmoil. It likes a very staid, inert political environment, which of course is also what has brought them into tension recently with the UAE and some of the UAE's slightly more ambitious political projects around the region. But for Saudi Arabia, that moment with Iran looks good and it feels encouraging. They are, I think, scratching their heads. The Iranians, of course, are saying, look, you are hosting these US military bases. They're saying they're not being used to attack you. But for the Iranians, this is a clear calculation to say, we need you to lobby on our behalf. But also, I think there is an element of Iran which says, by virtue of the fact you simply hold these bases and, you know, you give them proximity to us, they're here for a reason. And therefore, we regard that as a hostile act in this current environment.
So turning to the crisis that has been unleashed now by Operation Epic Fury and by the US-Israeli bombardment of the Islamic Republic and its military, and most notably the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, what impact has this had on the GCC states so far, economically and politically?
I think at the political level, there is a sense of shock because I don't think they expected the level of attack they've been subjected to. The Iranians have clearly adopted this swarm strategy with the drones, which are extremely easy to produce. They're relatively cost-effective to produce. They're very expensive to intercept. And they don't require a runway to launch them. So traditional methods of trying to counteract them by cratering Iranian runways, for example, is simply not effective. So they are having to rethink about how they will react to some of that. So that is having an impact. And it's clearly, if you look at the UAE, for example, a country that set itself up as the transit hub of the world's largest, sorry, busiest passenger airport, being shuttered first and only time since COVID that that's happened. That is quite significant. The economic impacts, again, are delirious for these countries, which rely, of course, on getting their goods out to the world through the Straits of Hormuz. And that's affecting both oil and gas. And we are really at the start in Europe and more broadly in the world of feeling the impact of that. Don't forget, even if it's not impacting us directly in terms of our strategic reserves, India, China are importing huge amounts of oil and gas, which come to them via the Straits of Hormuz. And so that will have knock-on effects for all of us in the coming weeks and months.
So thinking about these countries' relations with the Islamic Republic, do you think that they'll be, well, do you think that they'll be as willing to build a kind of détente or a modus operandi with Iran now after this?
I think it's really interesting to try and work through what the next moment looks like. I think there is a degree of sympathy, if that's the right word, for the Iranian position, because I think there was a feeling that the Iranians were being brought to heel through the negotiations that were taking place, and that they were, especially if you take the Omani position, they were giving up quite a lot, and they were in fact going much further than they'd ever gone before, but that some of that was still unacceptable. The other flip side to that, of course, is that Iran has run roughshod over the region for a number of years, in decades, in fact. And this hasn't just been through the development of a very prickly and sophisticated network of proxy movements all the way from Yemen through Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, but that the audacity of the Iranian intelligence services, the IRGC, to launch cross-border operations has also been pretty significant. So the Iranian government kidnapped and rendered Iranian citizens who had been based in Europe and running dissident news networks and so on, by luring them either via honeypots or other things into Turkey, into Iraq, and in one instance, intercepting a German-Iranian citizen who was living in California on a green card, who was transiting through the UAE, and they kidnapped him there, took him to Oman, and then from Oman by boat to Iran. All of the three of these individuals were executed. And so there has been this sense that Iran isn't respecting the territorial integrity of its neighbors, that it is running intelligence operations of a pretty brutal nature in those countries. And so I think these countries are now in a position where they'll look at the situation and say, this has happened. Their advice, from my understanding, and people I've spoken to in the Saudi government at least, will be to say to the Iranians, okay, you are now in this moment where you've come under the cosh from the Israelis and the Americans. it's really up to you what happens next. You can either give up this regional adventurism and start to look inwards and continue your political project at home and be at peace with your neighbors, or you can keep going and accept that under conventional terms, you don't have the ability to fight either Israel or America, let alone both at the same time.
Do you think there's anyone in the Iranian system who will be responsive to that kind of message?
That's the difficult thing. I'm not an Iran expert. I'm looking at Iran through the context of what I know of the region and trying to apply a historical lens of what we've seen elsewhere that happened there. I think two things or three things are probably illustrative. The first one is the IRGC is a hulking and significant institution within the context of Iran. Some estimates suggest it's worth between a third and two-thirds of the entire Iranian economy. So this is not an insignificant actor within Iran. And of course, a lot of the senior leadership and so on have economic interests and family members in the West. And so for them, there has to come a moment at which they recognize that it is in their own very basic self-interest from a selfish perspective to try and reach a settlement which allows them to remain in power and to simply adopt a slightly more neutered approach to the international community. That lesson has been learned by other radical millenarian groups. We can see that with the return to power of the Taliban in Afghanistan. They have broadly now been in power for 4 or 5 years and have relationships with China, have relationships with their neighbors. They occupy their seat at the UN. It's not a country that people are necessarily worrying about causing bloodshed on the streets of Manhattan, for example. And the same approach was adopted by Ahmed al-Sharra when he was, you know, guerrilla leader Abu Muhammad al-Jolani up in Idlib, where he looked at what his one-time colleague, the leader of ISIS, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, was doing in eastern Syria, and how he continued to provoke the West, how he continued to kill Western citizens on TV, ultimately provoking a furious backlash that led to the demise of his entire political project. And so, being more pragmatic, Ahmed al-Sharra said, you know, we will ensure that our territory is not a launch pad for external operations, and we'll develop a program that is inward looking. I think at some level or at some stage, the Iranian administration will realize that. The question is, how long does it take them to get to that point? And that's where the danger of the escalation trap lies, I think.
And if at some point in the future, the IRGC and Iran's supreme leader are feeling in a more pragmatic mood, do you think they'll be willing to weaken their hold over their various regional proxies in Iraq, in Lebanon, and in Yemen?
Well, I think now is the moment for that. They are historically weak in terms of those partnerships and alliances. Hezbollah has been hit very hard in Lebanon. That's not to say it's not still a relevant force. I think people who are saying it's in terminal decline are being somewhat optimistic. It does remain a relevant and potent force. However, it has never been weaker. It has been hit significantly. And more importantly, Iran's ability to nourish Hezbollah has also been affected, because the primary mechanism by which it was doing that was through the air bridge provided via Damascus. Of course, the new administration in Syria is not allowing that to take place. And even in fact, as the war broke out, Syrian government forces were sent to reinforce the border, not just with Lebanon, but also with Iraq, to ensure that smuggling routes are being monitored more closely. And so you can see, in terms of that deployment of resources, this is something they're very alive to. They're alive to it, of course, for two reasons. They are not favorably disposed to the Iranian government, which has spent years killing them, but also they are sensitive to the fact that they don't want to be sucked into a conflict with either Israel or America, having just emerged from a very brutal 14 years of civil war.
Yeah. And I'd like to turn briefly to Yemen and the Houthis, who seem to have been strangely quiet during this crisis. Do you have any idea of why that might be?
I think, again, it is a moment of weakness for the Houthis. If you look at Israel's post, you know, October 7th response, they have systematically gone around the region targeting one by one all of the different proxies or nodes of the Iranian network. And again, the Houthis have taken significant hit. Of course, the Saudis are also invested in counteracting the Houthis. And so what was really interesting in this context was after the assassination of Ali Khamenei was confirmed, these groups, including the Houthis, issued angry statements. But even in most of those statements, there was no direct threat of retaliation. So that's pretty unique in and of itself. And it speaks to where these groups are finding themselves at this moment. There is a recognition that Israel will respond and will act. And that's kind of understandable from the Israeli perspective after what happened on October 7th, that it has now emerged in a position, it's clearly developed a doctrine where it has decided that the era of both tolerating and managing via sort of careful titrations, the potency of this network that has surrounded them for decades is over. It's going to go in very hard and hit them to degrade them in very significant ways. Of course, Israelis know you cannot end these movements from an aerial campaign alone, but you can absolutely degrade them in very significant ways. And I think that's what's containing the Houthis now as much as anyone else.
And thinking about how perhaps a turn towards more pragmatic approaches from Iranian-aligned regional militias and groups, do we think that this will have the sort of the aggregate effect of this, if you will be to strengthen Saudi Arabia's hand in shaping the region or exercising its influence across the region?
I think the Saudis are in an interesting position at the moment. Of course, pre-October the 7th, there was a lot of talk about normalization and there was a political project that was certainly underway. That's been made very clear that that's off the table. So that's one part of the kaleidoscope of where Saudi's going to sit in the region. It is back to the old school position of normalization can and will take place contingent upon a settlement for the Palestinians that's deemed to be acceptable. More generally, there is also a sense of fear and unease amongst the Saudis that Israel has been allowed, as they would see it, by the United States to become the unparalleled military hegemon in the region. And again, I think there was a sense that they didn't necessarily want that to happen. So having an Iran prior to the outbreak of the war, which had sort of engaged in and signed up to a new series of settlements and deals, it was probably okay for the Saudi perspective because it represented a series of counterweights within the region. And you can see in terms of the internal discourse in Israel that they're alive to this too, because there's a lot of talk now about the Turks better not start to look to build a Sunni alliance. And that's the obvious next step, which is to say, could you then start to say, Iran's gone as a counterweight, even if you don't necessarily have a good relationship with them, they act as a counterweight nonetheless regionally. Maybe we need to build one now. And the Israelis are sort of saying, we're not prepared to tolerate that.
And there's always, going back decades, throughout the post-war period, this tension between America's alliance with Israel on the one hand and its allies with its Gulf partners on the other, particularly Saudi Arabia. How do you think this new status quo in the Middle East with a more boisterous and unencumbered Israel will shape America's relationship with Saudi Arabia and its allies in the Arab Gulf states?
Well, we're in a new position where, for the first time, of course, there are greater diplomatic negotiations and links between the Gulf states and Israel than there ever have been. And I think that's a positive trend. Even a country like Saudi Arabia, which doesn't have official relations, it's very evident, and of course no secret, that there are talks going on with the Israelis all the time. And that's, again, a change from where things were 20, 30 years ago. So I think that's all broadly positive. I think where it's now quite interesting, and again, what I've seen being discussed by both Saudi public figures, intellectuals, and more generally around the Gulf, is this sense that you can have this good relationship with the United States. It operates on two levels. So even when relations were tough with Joe Biden personally, at the diplomatic level, institutionally between, for example, the Saudi Ministry of Foreign Affairs and the US State Department, that continues pretty much as is and seamlessly. And there is political tension at the top level of personalities. Similarly, with Trump, it's the complete opposite. There is a very close understanding and relationship, and that extends to members of his family who are also in the administration, such as Kushner. What I've noticed now is there's a sense that you can have a good relationship with Trump, and that can also change on a dime. And they're talking about how, for example, Trump turned on Modi pretty quickly, and that gave Pakistan a series of quick diplomatic wins, which is pretty unprecedented. It doesn't normally happen in the context of India-Pakistan tensions. And they're feeling like here with Iran, that's kind of what happened. That yes, Netanyahu has a relationship with Trump and he's talking to him. That's understandable. But the Saudis and the UAE and others would feel like they have or should have at least an equal portion of the president's attention. In the absence of that, they're looking elsewhere and talking, of course, with China and others, which they've been doing for a while. It's worth contextualizing, though, just as I wrap this answer up, which is to say, when you look at the nuts and bolts, though, of the Saudi defense and security infrastructure in terms of hardware, training, expertise, and all that, that is still more integrated in a pretty inextricably way with the US defense contracting system than anything else. And that can't change and won't change overnight.
And Saudi Arabia obviously has one of the largest military budgets in the entire world at the moment.
Right.
And at a time when Western countries are rediscovering the importance of defense and deterrence, that is obviously a significant factor. That leads on quite nicely to what I wanted to ask you about next, which is these sweeping social and economic reforms that are taking place in many of the Gulf monarchies at the moment. Obviously, Saudi Arabia's Vision 2030 has sort of stolen the limelight in many ways, but other countries are pursuing similar agendas. Do you think that the current Gulf crisis represents a threat to those plans to reshape these societies and economies?
Well, it doesn't hurt it in the sense that if the war is over relatively soon, then this will be regarded as a blip. And I think the major damage comes from a reputational perspective. People, there's still a certain number of people who view the Middle East as just as a monolith, and it's just a dangerous, tricky part of the world. The Gulf states are very keen, of course, to distinguish themselves from the turmoil that has afflicted either the Levant or North Africa, to say, no, this is an oasis actually of stability, of prosperity, things work here, things are politically stable, you should come. And they've been quite good, I think, at actually managing to pierce the bubble with that. So in that context, drones, ballistic missiles, all of that is damaging. It's also damaging for consumer confidence. One of the things you've probably seen is that as part of the economic development and attempt to attract consumer investment into these countries has been a big push for AI data centers. And one of those has been hit. These are extremely capital intensive investments. And again, if these major companies aren't able to feel like their assets and their investments will be protected in a stable part of the world, and that they could be overturned or impacted by sort of whimsical series of events, then that is going to hurt. So I think now that the war has begun, it's going to be important for them to wrap this up as quickly as possible. Does it affect the bigger, longer-term plans of something like Vision 2030, the fact that Saudi will host the World Cup in a few years, or that Qatar has these big projects that it's aimed to do in the past and stuff? No, I don't think so right now. But if this becomes a seriously protracted conflict where the UAE is consistently having to shut down Dubai International Airport, for example, then that becomes a problem.
And I think a lot of the outside commentary on these plans like Vision 2030 often focus on the economic angle and can sometimes be quite dismissive of this as some kind of branding exercise or sports washing to try and improve these countries' reputation in the eyes of the world. But there is also an important kind of social aspect to these reforms when it comes to things like trying to promote more gender equality, however, you know, gradually, or trying to change social and religious attitudes. Do you think that an intensifying Iran-Saudi rivalry would threaten in some ways to derail that project, or is it not as fragile as some people have suggested?
I think we're in a different space now. In 1979, that was the response to the Iranian Revolution, to say, we need to become more conservative. We need to double down on our conservative Islamic credentials and to say, you know, we are the true vanguards of the faith. I think that moment has passed. We are into this era of quite clear sort of desire by the Gulf states to say our future is predicated on providing prosperity, opportunity, and stability through permissive leadership that's going to create an enabling environment for this kind of thing to happen. So I don't necessarily see it going that way. The important point will be how they can sustain and maintain these economic diversification projects. And that will be contingent upon being able to deliver stability. Of course, that's factored very clearly into the Iranian calculus in terms of saying there is a cost for you unless you lobby on our behalf.
And we've spoken before about how some of these initiatives are underscored by a kind of Islamic reformation taking place in Saudi Arabia. Can you just say a little bit more about that and what it means?
Yeah, I think that's the untold story, actually, of what's happening. There's a lot of talk about the fact that, you know, there's this entertainment district in Saudi Arabia and all of these sorts of things going on, and, you know, the fact that Shakira has performed in the kingdom and so on. But actually, away from all of that, I think in 2021, a very significant interview took place where Mohammed bin Salman, the crown prince, went on Saudi TV and was interviewed by a very prominent Saudi interviewer on domestic TV. It was a very wide-ranging interview, lasted several hours, and they talked about all kinds of things, economy, politics, and so on. But there is a portion of the discussion where they talk about religion. And this was really significant because Mohammed bin Salman had previously mentioned religious reform, but often at economic conferences to attract investment, saying, you know, we are changing, things are happening. And these were sort of to Western audiences. But this time he's speaking to the Arab world and speaking specifically to the Saudis and his Saudi constituency. And what he's begun to do is to essentially say there is actually a lot of wiggle room with respect to Islamic law, and that it is not this incredibly rigid, inflexible thing the way that conservatives have traditionally tried to make it. And so without making this a very complicated discussion, he says the actual rules in Islam, which are absolute and clear-cut, are quite few. And of course, those rules, he's still speaking to Saudi, and he says the Quran is our constitution, it will be our constitution forever, and so on. Those rules, of course, must be implemented, you know, as God has stated them. He said, but the vast majority of rules, there is some wiggle room with them in terms of how you consider them, how you apply them. And then, and this is where it gets really interesting, he says, they have to be weighed against the public interest. And once you get to that point, he would say, you know, the public interest is determined by us, by the House of Saud, by myself as the executive, of course, as, you know, the de facto king, as everyone understands him to be at this moment in time. And so he could say, we can suspend certain rules. And there's a big role within Islam of things such as the role of custom, for example. So to give an example, when women couldn't drive in Saudi Arabia, there's no actual scriptural injunction for that. There's this principle known as urf, custom. And he would use that. And so the women's rights activists who would challenge it would say, you can change customs and norms. Right, social norms change in all societies over time. Sometimes government leads on that, sometimes they happen organically. And so that was obviously something that did change in Saudi. Women can now drive. And what's interesting, I talked to my students about this at King's, if you go to Saudi Arabia, if you go into downtown, middle of Riyadh, where people are more likely to have been educated abroad and so on, you will find women driving. But if you even go to the suburbs of Riyadh, you won't find basically any women driving because it's just not what they do. And that's the custom and that's all. So Mohammed bin Salman is getting into this space of dealing with the urf and saying, times are changing, the customs are changing, and we need Saudi Arabia to change in relation to that. Therefore, what is in the public interest today is not what was in the public interest 40 years ago. And he's arguing for this change within a distinctly Islamic framework. What makes that so significant is that, unlike most other world leaders, he actually has the authority to do it, the capacity to do it, but also the understanding. So when he speaks in this interview, you know, he is speaking with a good degree of knowledge and reference to Islamic jurisprudence and to the framework of Islamic law in a way that I can't imagine a lot of even other Muslim rulers doing. So that is significant. It's important. I think it's also part of him putting the religious establishment in Saudi Arabia on notice. Times are changing. And with reference to your own framework that matters to you guys, here's how it's going to change.
And do you think that that changed message, this reformation, if you will ripple outwards to other countries, perhaps like Pakistan or Syria, places where Saudi Arabia has historically tried to build up its influencer networks?
I think so. I mean, think with Saudi, the change is happening and it is taking root. Saudi society is very different today. It's worth saying I grew up in Saudi Arabia as a child in the 1980s. So I'm not Saudi, but I watch it very closely. I obviously have an affinity with the place because I spent so much time there. And so when I look at the changes now and I speak to young Saudis, of course, majority of whom weren't alive when I was living there, they're in a different place and they're in a different space. And I think, therefore, developed, progressive, outward-looking Saudi Arabia is actually good for Islam as a whole. It's good for traditional partners of Saudi Arabia because it's demonstrating that there is a different way of doing things and of being a country that has Islam that's part of it, that's important to it, that's an inimical part of its identity, but which is also productive and at ease within the nations of the world and very much a part of the international community.
Now, I'm loath to go against such a positive right. note, but bringing things back now to the crisis that's unfolding with the US-Iran conflict, might there be some kind of fallout beyond the Middle East, in Europe and in the West? Do we think that the way in which this campaign has been carried out with the assassination of the supreme leader, Ali Khamenei, might in some ways fuel further Islamist extremism in the West?
There's probably two things to weigh up in this context. The first is the IRGC and Iranian intelligence more generally have clearly been looking to cultivate an offensive arm beyond just the regional proxies that they've had in the Levant or in southern Arabian Peninsula. And so we've seen repeatedly arrests or the breakup of cells in Europe, North America that are tied back to Iran. There was, of course, an arrest in the United States just a few days ago of an alleged plotter who was targeting Donald Trump. But we've also seen plots, disrupted in Europe that have targeted synagogues or Jewish schools and symbols of Jewish life in Europe. So I think that is an aspect where we could realistically expect to see an uptick of increased threat over the years. Again, a lot of that will depend on what the Iranian government decides it wants its immediate future to look like. If it wants to be self-interested, it will give all of that up and essentially accept the status quo as exists now, which is it can survive if it lives within its borders. Or it can continue this aggressive posturing and face a protracted war where their leaders and by extension their families will continue to die. And I think they'll get to that point in the end because they cannot win a conventional war against the West. So it's just what happens in the meantime. And I think that's the difficult moment. Like, we don't really know what they'll do. Others have learned the lesson, but they learned it after decades of fighting. Taliban took 2 decades to get there. So will the Iranians learn the lessons of history from others? We don't know. I think that's the dynamic. More generally, of course, the pattern of terrorism we've seen in the West has been driven by the Sunnis. And it's been driven in relation to conflicts in the Muslim world around traditional aspects which have, I suppose, inflamed Sunni passions. The sectarian divide has become quite pronounced. 2003 was important, but what Iran did in Syria, it can't be understated in terms of the psychological impact that had on a lot of Sunnis. And so I think people are kind of conflicted right now who are otherwise inspired politically to think and act in response to Muslim causes. I don't think by any stretch of the imagination they are happy to see either Israel or America bombing Iran, but they're not also necessarily feeling compelled to act in the defense of Iran because of that sectarian divide becoming quite pronounced. And I think an example is probably illustrative. He's deceased now, but the former sort of broadly believed to be spiritual guide of the Muslim Brotherhood, a guy called Yusuf al-Qaradawi, who lived in Qatar actually for a number of years, but originally Egyptian, had to flee, of course. In 2006, when the war between Hezbollah and Israel took place, he supported vocally Hezbollah and called on Sunnis to support them. And a lot of the traditional clerics in Saudi and elsewhere were saying, "What are you doing? It's a Shia movement." And they rebuked him. And he said, You need to think about the bigger prize here, the bigger goal. They're fighting the Israelis, and we need to support them, regardless of the fact that they're Shia. And once Hezbollah and Iran in particular directly started to intervene in Syria to kill the Sunnis there, it wasn't just the fact they were supporting Bashar al-Assad, but the level of sectarian insult that they injected into the conflict and the way that was foregrounded and it's part of the regime's response to the uprising shocked a lot of people. And Qardawi himself apologized to the broader world of, sort of Sunni clerics in the Gulf, saying, "You were right and I was wrong." And so we've seen in places like Syria, when Khamenei was assassinated, the mosques celebrating rather than mourning.
So finally, will the current crisis fundamentally reshape the Middle East? Are we looking at a turning point in Middle Eastern history here?
I've seen Lindsey Graham saying that a lot, and I'm loath to agree with him.
Wise man.
Yeah, exactly. Here's what I think. I think this will have some impact. But in terms of, is this a solo event? I would say we need to go back to October 7th. Israel has clearly decided it's going to change the balance of power in the Middle East. It's going to change the way things have been done for the last basically half century in the region. And in doing so, it's trying to curtail this real proliferation of non-state actors that has taken place. I mean, a whole smorgasbord of groups in Iraq, a powerful, you know, state within a state in southern Lebanon and stuff. So in that context, actually, the reshaping of the Middle East has been taking place since October the 7th, and this calculus by the Israelis directly to go after these groups. Now the fact that America is involved changes the dynamic a little bit because they are directly intervening against Iran. That also means America will be part of the settlement. And in a way that the Saudis or the Qataris, for example, might not have been speaking to the Israelis about their objectives in Iraq, in Lebanon, and indeed the Israelis probably wouldn't be listening to them on those. Now, particularly having felt they've been slighted in terms of the outbreak of the war, I would expect to see an intensive diplomatic lobbying effort by the Saudis, by the Qataris, and the Emiratis in Donald Trump's ear to ensure that the reshaping of the Middle East, whenever the current crisis with Iran comes to an end, is something that reflects some of their interests. And I would, as I say, just push that into the broader sense of the way Iran is being neutered in terms of its regional Rolodex.
Shiraz, thank you very much.
Thank you.